Good morning, everyone. Hope we all had a good night's sleep. The subject of the angels is one that it's so big that I hope this weekend we could just like help you get a piece of what's happening in the angels' lives. This is a study that you'll take from here, take back to your homes. You're doing your Bible readings in your house, so you're listening to talks at Bible schools and gatherings. And all of a sudden now, maybe the level of awareness about what angels are doing is a little bit higher in all of our lives. But it's really a study that you have to take home and personally really finish. And we can only begin the study this weekend. As you can see, we're never going to get to all the passages about angels. Some of you have asked me about, well, when are we going to get to this passage or that passage? There really isn't time in one weekend to look at them all. Fortunately, we can do that with our computer Bibles today. We can look them up and we can go through those passages. And we get some of them that way. But if you're really going to do a study of them all, it's really something that has to be done through daily Bible readings. Because and your mind has to be thinking about angels, because as you've seen, there are places where angels pop up in our Bibles, and it doesn't say angels. We have to be looking for them in order to see them. But the story that we left off with yesterday, I think, is one of the ones that first got me interested, because there's no doubt about these angels. I couldn't miss it when I was reading a Bible. Even though it isn't a subject that we hear a lot about, it definitely tells us they were angels. So we want to pick up in Genesis 19 and finish that story this morning, and then we'll look at a few other things. Jacob's life is one of the beautiful lives in Genesis that are recorded about angels. I think God has left on record for us through the lives of Adam and Eve, and then through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. In the book of Genesis, we have enough stories about the work of angels that you could spend a whole gathering just looking at those. Because the angels were so involved in their lives, and those people knew it. They knew it, because it was forced upon them in a sense. Although you can see in the reading that we just did about Jacob, Jacob's a bit surprised. Did you notice that? He didn't realize that the angels were in that place. He was going off on his own, wandering away from his home, on his way up into Syria, not knowing what was going to happen in his life, and he didn't realize the angels were walking with him. And they weren't coming down and back up again, as many of you have picked up on. The angels were ascending and descending upon that ladder, because they were there with him all the time, going up to the Father, coming back down, but they started here. That's the way that the vision is described. And that is neat to notice about the angels. They're here now. They're going to walk away from this place with us, and they're not going to leave us. And it's nice to be aware of their presence. Well, we left off in Genesis 18 with a little discussion that Abraham had with that angel in Genesis 18. Remember, the three angels showed up, and the three of them had their little discussion about, should we tell Abraham what we're going to do? Because they had plans about going down and seeing about Sodom and Gomorrah. They had heard something about Sodom and Gomorrah that they came down to find out about themselves. And after giving Abraham and Sarah the news about having a child, they had their little discussion and decided they can't hold from Abraham what they're going to do. This was too massive, too big. Abraham had probably been praying about Lot, and they just couldn't go down there and destroy Sodom and Gomorrah without talking to Abraham first. And that's a neat side of the angel's character as well, to realize that they have those kind of feelings about us, that they care. They care about how we're going to respond. They don't want to just bring surprises on us all the time like that. So the one angel's talking with Abraham as we left off in Genesis 18 yesterday, and Abraham's having this discussion, thinking there must be some of my family left down there. You know, Abraham's community is so big right now, he can grab 300 men and go rescue Lot when he needs to, back in Genesis 14. So when the kings came down, they took the Sodom. So Abraham was probably thinking that Lot must have had at least, you know, a fairly good sized little community with him when they came to have a meeting in the morning, that there would be a little gathering like this of people that must have been accumulated in Sodom. Although it does seem that Abraham and Lot had a bit lost touch with each other as Lot got closer to Sodom. So the two angels come down to Sodom in the evening. So now we have two angels coming down, and they come down to find out, as they said, they had to find out if what they had heard about Sodom is true. And that's a part of the angel's character that I hope we've come to realize this weekend, is that the angels don't know everything. They don't have God's omnipresence that he has up in heaven. They can't just sit up in heaven and watch the whole world unfolding like we might sometimes envision they do. They need to actually come down, investigate. They ask questions when they come in, and they say, have you got any other family here, anybody else? They don't come in presupposing they know everything. They actually come in and investigate, as we saw in Genesis 11 as well. So in Genesis 19, they come down, and they come down to investigate how things are with Lot. And when Lot sees them, he rises up to meet them, bows himself with his face toward the ground. Now, of course, lest we forget, it's very easy to write off Lot, isn't it? If all we had in our Bibles was Genesis 18 and 19, no New Testament, no Peter commentary on this, how many of us really would have thought Lot had any hope? That tells us something about ourselves, though. We tend to see the worst in people, and I think all of us, myself included, we'd read this story about Lot, and we would write him off, especially as the story unfolds, and even after he's rescued, he has children by his daughters, and it's like, it leaves you laying like that. We walk away from that, and we'd say, there can't be any hope for Lot, can there? I mean, look at what he did. And yet, with Peter's commentary in the New Testament, it gives you a different side of Lot. It helps us realize that, and I think it's good for us, because some of us may sit in situations like this. We may have people here today who are married to spouses who are not interested in the truth. And you're tangled up in a life of in and out of things with God and godly people. We have children who are in those circumstances with their own parents. And yet you can identify with Lot. He's got one foot in Sodom and one foot in with his God. And he's a man who's torn. And that doesn't mean he's lost. It just means he's a brother who's struggling. And somebody was listening to his prayers. I really think somebody must have said what those angels said when they came down and they said, and they had their discussion, we're going to come down because of what we had heard. Somebody must have been talking to them. And if it wasn't Lot, maybe it was Abraham, but somebody was sending up prayers to God about rescuing them out of this situation. And it wouldn't surprise me if it was Lot. Lot, put yourself in his shoes. What do you do now? You're stuck in Sodom. Your family's in there. They're attached. They're in this city now. You can't just yank them out. You're afraid that they'll all walk away from you. And he's trapped in a sense at this point, and he wants a way out. It's not a whole lot different than Jacob struggling with that angel that we just read about in the other story. His family was falling apart. And he gets to a point where you just grab onto an angel and you say, do something, please, to save this family of mine. This ecclesia that I'm in. Do something to rescue us out of this because we can't find a way out. And you could imagine Lot doing the same thing as it vexed his righteous soul about the conduct of these people and the impact that that was having in his family. So the angels show up, and I think some of the fun things that you can see out of Genesis 19 is, you know, you get this feeling about how angels, they're so human in a sense. You can see the emotions that angels have. You can see that in the sense that they'll sit down and they'll have a meal with Abraham like they did. You know, just like we would do. If somebody shows up at your house and you invite them in, as our hosts have done this weekend, and every time we walk in, they offer us some food and we sit down at the table and we have something to eat and discuss things. The angels were very much like that. But look at how they handled this situation when the morning dawned, because we all know the story, and we know how the angels, they blinded the people out in front of the house. But in verse 15, the angels urged Lot to hurry. They didn't just take Lot right away. They said, come on, Lot, we got to go. Like maybe some of your parents did this morning in order to get you here on time. They wake you up in the morning, they get you moving, you eat your breakfast, and then let's go, we got to get out of here. But, you know, this is the human side of these angels. They acted like people. They were like parents in the house. And they say, let's go. We've got to get going. Arise and take your wife and your two daughters that are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. They knew that was coming. They knew that the other angel probably, or some angels, were going to actually rain fire and brimstone down. And then as he lingered in verse 16. Now, we could look at that. Think about that. If that was us, and we're trying to help a brother or sister along, and we know that we need to get them out, but they're lingering. They're not getting moving. And we could look at that and we could say, well, there's more evidence that Lot, he really didn't want to leave. He really didn't want to get out of there, and we could easily write Lot off. But what the men did is they reached out and they touched him. They take hold of his hand, his wife's hands, and the hands of his two daughters. And you can imagine these angels just grabbing these people and physically leading them out of the city. And there you see it, the Lord being merciful to him. Those are the angels that are still here working with us. That's the way they feel about you. That's the kind of attachment that they have. Even if you're in situations where you don't want to be there, you're stuck in a place like Sodom and you're praying that God will rescue you out of it, the angels will do those kind of things for us. And they'll grab us by the hand and bring us out. But when it's time to go, We've got to go. And when they bring us out of the city. So they bring him out and they set him outside the city. But that isn't the end of the story. You keep on going. In verse 17, it comes to pass. They brought him outside. He says, escape for your life. Don't look behind you. Don't stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. And we might think, well, you know, if an angel did that for us and asked you rescued us out of the city, wouldn't you do what they said? I mean, really, we'd think, boy, if you got rescued out of that place and angels actually showed up and talked to us, we'd think, boy, if they said, get out of this place, get out of the plain, going up in the hills, well, I'll do whatever they say. That isn't what Lot did. And yet, look at how patient they were with him. Lot says, please, no, my lords. Indeed, now if your servant found favor in your sight, and you've increased your mercy, which you've shown to me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. Can you imagine saying that to an angel at this point where he's rescuing you out of the city? And now you say, well, look, can we sort of divert your plans a little bit? I don't want to go up into the mountains, lest some evil come upon me and I die up there in the mountains. Can't we sort of modify the plans a little bit and maybe go over to this little city over here? See this little city over here in verse 20? It's a little one. Please let me escape there. Isn't it just a little one and my soul shall live? And look what the angels do. He says to him, see, I found favor concerning, I have favored you concerning this thing also, and that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Now, there's angels modifying their plans, making changes in what they were going to do. We were talking with some of the young people last night about pathways that God has established, and God says he's going to do something. And what about modifying those paths? There's angels modifying what they were going to do. That city maybe was in the plans to overthrow over in Zoar, and now because Lot has asked specifically that they will accommodate him to go over to that little city, the angels are willing to do that. And that is a neat side of the angel's character. And it shows you some of the freedom that they have in handling a situation that they can actually accommodate. And although, brothers and sisters, we can't see those angels today, and you can't see them right here in this room, we can talk to them. We can pray to our God. And in the same way that Lot could talk to them literally right there, God will answer those prayers. Maybe not exactly like we wanted. He can't accommodate everything that we ask. But if we don't ask, how can we ever receive? And in this case, look at how brave Lot was even to ask. And you can see that in this case, I really think that he probably asked to be rescued out of the city in the first place. And we certainly know with Jacob, that Jacob, in a story that we just read, he's struggling with that angel. He's grabbing a hold of that angel and he's begging that angel to do something in the life of his family. So the angel says to him in verse 22, look, hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. And he waited. And of course, you know the story as it goes on. So these aren't new stories, but when you look at them from the perspective of the angel, sometimes they come across a little bit different. In Genesis 19, then at verse 25, he overthrew those cities. Sodom and Gomorrah gets destroyed, all the inhabitants of those cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And although we don't know exactly how that happened, if you use your imagination a little bit, you can imagine that the angels that showed up, the two that came there, and they take Lot out of the city, they grab a hold of their hands and literally lead them out of the city. They talk to Lot about the accommodation of going over to Zoar. You know, it must be that those angels didn't know what Lot's wife was going to do. They didn't know ahead of time she was going to look back. I can even envision a situation where they're leading them out of the city, they're walking out with them, trying to get them out, get them over to Zoar, and the two angels that were working in that situation were probably not even the same angels who turned Lot's wife into a pillar of salt. There's probably other angels involved. They're watching over the situation. And it's one of those stories where they might have been quite surprised at what happened. They might have been hoping beyond hope that they could get Lot and his wife and his two daughters and at least get them out of the city in one piece. And here they are trying to do their work, and all of a sudden she looks back, and somebody has to do the work of turning her into a pillar of salt. And it may have been the third angel that had showed up at this point from over with Abraham. But it helps when you read those stories now, just think about how that actually worked out. And I think you'll see a side of the angels that maybe we haven't looked at in the past. Well, if you look at some of the things that you can pick up from Genesis 18 and 19, I thought this one was worth summarizing because there's so much you can learn from Genesis 18 and 19. This one little section of the Bible tells us a lot about angels. We find out they can appear as normal men. I think it really comes out clear they really do want to save us. They do. And this comes out in this story. They are so interested in saving us and getting us out of the evil. When we pray in that Lord's Prayer and deliver us from evil, I mean, that evidently was the prayer that was going up to them that they came down to investigate, and they literally delivered Lot out of the evil in this case. They can develop a personal relationship with us, as you find with Abraham and the angel that he talks with. You'll see that with Moses and the angel that he talks with. And I think even Lot probably overnight at least learned to identify a bit with his angels, enough so that he felt comfortable asking them, oh, please, can I go over and can I just settle in this city over here? You wouldn't do that with somebody that you're so awestruck about, that this man is so powerful he just blows you away. We wouldn't do that. But this is the side of God's working with us, that he sends angels to be involved because God would overpower us. And yet he doesn't want us to be pushed away from him as those people were on the mountain when they came up in Exodus 19. He wants us to be drawn to him. And the angels are his way of doing that on a human level that we can identify with. We find out they can read our thoughts as they did with Sarah, and they know what we're even thinking. We find out that they need to be present to know what's happening. That may surprise some of us to think about angels. I can remember being surprised at that myself. I just thought they knew everything that was going on. But so often they have to come down to see what's going on. And they show up and they say, do you have any other family? They're asking questions about what's really happening in this situation before they go and act. I think it's nice to know they are willing to reason with us. It's not the pathway to the kingdom. It's not something that's flow charted out already, and we don't have any impact on how that flow chart runs. And although it may be flow charted, and there's all these different pathways that could happen, and God knows which one is going to happen in the end, that's foreknowledge. He doesn't make that pathway happen. That each one of those decision times are up to us. What are we going to do? What are we going to do when we leave here? There's all these pathways in front of us when we leave this weekend of what we can do next week. And all those pathways are open up. And many of those God can work with. But he leaves us the free will and the individual choice about which decision are we going to make all along the way. And then he tries to work with those and guide those decisions into making good choices with us. I think it's nice to note that the angels, they're willing to accommodate us within reason. That is not a fixed plan. They're willing to make accommodations. And this is where prayer is powerful. When we pray about things that we really want for our ecclesia or for our family, things that we want which are going to, we really believe are going to help our family grow or help our ecclesia to grow. It's not a whole lot different than Jacob holding onto that angel, and he would not let go until that angel blessed him. He wasn't going to let go. And he held on and he held on until finally he got what he was after from that angel. They discuss with each other to make decisions. That's another interesting aspect of the angels when they would sit and talk about, well, what do you think? Should we tell Abraham what we're going to do? What do you think? And these are relationships that we all experience now. We don't just, husband doesn't just operate in his own little world and wife doesn't know what's going on and neither with the wife. We have to discuss these things. We have to act like angels and talk and make plans and work things out because we're all trying to accomplish the same goal. And they certainly are extremely patient. I think that's something we'll find out about angels very clear, is they are very patient, willing to wait and wait and wait, hoping for the day in which we will respond. If you, there's a whole series of stories we could look at. I mean, we could look at Jacob's life, Joseph's life, Isaac's life. There's so many stories about angels. But I just wanted to go ahead and just look at a couple other ones, and we'll come back to the one about Jacob at the end. If you look over in 1 Kings 19, and this is a side of the angels which I really think holds the human side about angels. Angels are not so far above us that they can't come down and identify with us, talk to us. And you'll find with angels, they have that personal side about them that they don't just come and talk to us. Angels, they'll reach out and they'll touch. They actually touch people because they want to get that personal relationship. Now, we have brethren and sisters in ecclesial life that we're sort of standoffish, and we sort of like, we're even hesitant to go up and give a hug or shake a hand. You look at the angels at how often they touch, because they want that identification there. They want you to realize how much they are identifying with us, they're in tune with us, and they really want you to be drawn to them so that they can lead us down a good pathway. In 1 Kings 19, you see that with, in this case, I think it's with Elisha that he's praying. This is Elijah we got up to, but that's probably the one worth looking at. In 1 Kings 19, the reason I like 1 Kings 19 is because, of all places, this would be a place where we could build a case that the angels should have left this man alone. Because what's Elijah doing in 1 Kings 19? He's just been up there on Mount Carmel. You know, he's just brought down the fire of God. He's thought he's accomplished this goal of 3.5 years of holding off the rain, and now he's won the community over to his side. He's shown the prophets of Baal are worthless, and Yahweh was right. He comes running down through the valley there on his way down, and he's running with the king ahead of the chariot. And what does he find out? Jezebel's ready for him, and she's going to destroy him. And he just figures 3.5 years are wasted, and God's let him down. The people have let him down. This man is depressed. He's a man who was so involved in ecclesial life, he gave years of his life of living in poverty, having birds feed him and bring him food, hoping that this community would change. And he thinks he's finally done it by his plans, and he thinks he's accomplished the change in the community. He runs down and he finds out that this woman, Jezebel, she's going to kill him. And he leaves the land, runs off in despair, on his way down to Mount Sinai. He's going to go meet with God and have a discussion. And if we just read 1 Kings 19, we might think he's just going down there to talk with God about what do we do next. But when you add into that Romans 11, remember what Paul said? How Elijah went down to make intercession against Israel. He went down there asking God to wipe out those people that wouldn't respond to what he'd done. This isn't Moses. This isn't Moses coming in and asking God, you know, if not, blot me out of the book of life. This man goes down there and says, I only am left. No appreciation for the prophet who's back there hiding prophets in the caves trying to keep a few people alive. Lost touch with 7,000 in Israel that hadn't bowed their knees. I look at this man, I call it the Elijah syndrome in the truth, where brethren sometimes get so involved in their way of doing things, thinking it's the only way, and if you don't get on board, that you're lost and hopeless. This man had come to this point in his life, and the angels needed to bring him around. They didn't write him off. They just looked at him as a wayward brother who had a lot of potential. Somebody who, if we just fine-tune him a little bit and get his sights a little readjusted, this man is a wonderful brother in Christ. But right now, he's got some major things to learn. And where better to learn them with discussions with the angels down on Mount Sinai. And he comes down and angels talk to him on Mount Sinai. But this angel, first of all, meets him. This isn't the one probably who later on comes and talks with him. But this angel meets him, touches him, and says, look, you need some help. You're not going to make it on your journey. This is his journey where he's going down to intercede against Israel. And the angel helps him out, gives him some food, or get up and eat. That once, he does it twice. Twice to help this man get down there, get the strength to get down and work out in his mind these confusing things that were going on in Elijah's mind. This is a fascinating story about the work of the angels. And it shows you how patient, how kind they are, how willing to work with scenarios where we're mixed up in life. We haven't got our sights exactly right. We got the wrong views about the community and about our brothers and sisters, and they don't write us off. They realize we just need some little fine-tuning to get back on track. And that's what they'll do. They'll do it. And if they'll do that, what in the world are we doing writing people off? If that's how patient the angels are, and that's how willing they are to cut people some slack of they have some bad days, you know, they've been very involved. This man had been involved for 3.5 years, making it a daily matter of prayer. There'd be no rain. There's going to be no rain. Hoping that his plan was going to bring about the salvation of the nation. And he'd been through the emotional high up there on Mount Carmel. This man had given his all. And yet, the angels just looked at that and said, this man has a lot of potential. This is like an Apostle Paul. All you got to do is get him going in the right direction, and that's okay. But if they're so patient like that and so kind, I hope all of us can take something home this weekend about how we treat each other. Because this is what we want to be. We want to learn to be people like this, like the angels that cut folks some slack and realize we don't write these people off. We just find better ways to work with them and sort of bring them back into the community a little differently. So the angel of the Lord says to Elijah, this is the one in 2 Kings 1. It was the other one that I was going to look at, where again, you can just see another case where the angels talk with, in this case, with Elijah when he was going up to meet with the king of Israel at that point. And it's just another case where the angels are just so patient with him. They encourage him to go. And that's what they're there for. They're ministering spirits that are sent forth to minister for those who shall be heirs of salvation. There was one other passage that I wanted to just touch on this weekend before we leave. And just it's one of those verses that you stick at the bottom of your notes somewhere about angels. And actually, I left it for the last class and figured that, well, at least you can't leave a study of the angels without referring to this one. For those of you that do an angel study and you go through all the passages about angels, eventually you end up in Job 4. Now, in Job 4, this is Eliphaz speaking. And just so we're careful when we use the story of Job, one of the things that Christadelphians do sometimes is we tend to think that we can use the whole Bible and that the whole Bible tells us all the right things about God. And so we find verses and sometimes we pull them a bit out of context. And just so that we don't ever make that mistake with this passage, make sure you make a note next to this one that the man who said this, Eliphaz, in Job chapter 4, he's not giving us something that's true about the angels. He's actually telling us something that's wrong. And Eliphaz, he has to have his thinking corrected as the story of Job goes along, because his view of God is one in which God is just like ticking off points and watching us, and he sees this idea that you do this little wrong, and God's going to bring something into your life, that he's going to punish you right now in this life to the degree of which you've committed this sin, and it's just like a little checklist to make sure that we go off, and he's so much like, he even charges his angels with error. This is the kind of God that Eliphaz understood. And it took a while for all of them in this story to realize that that's not the God that we worship. So Job 4 is one that you want to make sure you make a note of, that that's Eliphaz. And you can find a lot of things that Eliphaz said that aren't quite right. Same with the other two friends, Zophar included. In Matthew 18, we had to get there this weekend, Matthew 18. Some of you have mentioned a little bit about, what about Matthew 18? What about, do we have guardian angels? That's the common phrase. Actually, Brother Reuben and I had an interesting discussion about the guardian angels yesterday, and we'll continue that discussion for a while. But one thing that came out of that is maybe the phrase guardian angel isn't a good one. I know my dad he uses the phrase that each one of us has an angel assigned to them, just from looking at enough Bible stories like Jacob and like this passage right here. It's possible that that all of us have an angel that's assigned. And whether it's assigned to us our entire life, or whether the angels trade off and they decide that this brother Jim here, he's too rough to work with. Anybody else want to take on this task? Possibly those kind of things happen. Maybe there's little things that go on amongst the angels. But in Matthew 18, it's one of those common passages that we look at. But we have to look at it from the perspective of angels. I mean, of course, the issue that was going on was the children were coming to the meeting. And, you know, sometimes brethren and sisters say, well, the children don't belong in the meeting, right? Because, they don't belong here. They're going to distract us or they're going to do whatever. Although these kids are all being perfect this weekend, see? But Jesus, when the children were coming to see him, he didn't push them away. He didn't say they don't belong here. He said, instead, what we need to do is look at the children. Look at the positive things that we can learn from them and take those positive things and learn to implement them ourselves. Now, that's a pretty simple lesson, isn't it? And it doesn't really just apply to children. If we could apply that to each other a lot of times, we'd be much better off. But instead of looking at all the negative things, look at the positive things about people when they come to meeting. Look at the things that people do that they help out. Look at the parts of their life that they bring that I'm not very good at. And look what I can learn from that person about how to be a better servant of Christ. And from the children, we can certainly look at how they do in such simple ways. They trust the things that their mom and dad do. And then mom and dad say, we're going to go here. And they just trust. Well, mom and dad must have a good reason. Or they say to wear this today. Or whatever it happens to be. Because to such that have minds like that, that's the way we have to get with God. We need to. It's not an optional thing. It's something we have to develop. And those children, they already have it in relation to us. But not only do they have that, they're angels up in heaven. Their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. And if he could say that about these children that are here now, that their angels, always see the face of my Father who is in heaven, then there must be a sense in which angels have already been assigned that are working with the little children already. God doesn't wait until we're 19 and we're baptized to say, well, now we need an angel. Now we need an angel. How can we do that? If you were doing that, you couldn't do that either. That would be like saying in parenting skills that, well, we don't need to parent them until they get a little older. Or it would be like saying, well, there's no sense bringing your children to meeting. They can't understand anything yet. You might as well wait until they're 12 or 13 or 14, and we'll bring them to meeting. We'll start telling them about God. That isn't the way it works. Angels have to be there all the time. Look at all the things that children do in their lives. Look at all the things that happen in your home, the things that go on at school, the places where there are angels there all the time, interacting, finding out what's happening in their lives, learning about these children, and making sure that they protect them from situations. And we pray that they will protect them. Look at what parent here right now has not prayed for their child at school, or prayed for their child when they go somewhere, or prayed for their child. And what do we think those prayers are if they aren't the fact that there are angels literally there with them, walking with them, watching over the things that happen in their life? And that's the way I see it. And I think you'll see that's what ends up happening in Jacob's life at the end when he realized that the angels really there were really there with him. Now, let's go back and look at Jacob for a minute, and maybe we'll end up a little bit with Jacob. We got to at least look at Jacob and maybe a little bit at Moses if we get time. But go back and pick up Jacob's life. And I think enough about Jacob's life is revealed here that you can see the impact that the angels had in his life. When Jacob, with all of his scheming, and really Jacob in a sense, the name Jacob Israel forever became the Israel today. Because Jacob's life is so typical of every one of our lives. Everybody in here should be able to identify in some way or another with Jacob. We all run the pattern of scheming, making our plans, getting what we can as we're younger, and we think that we're doing all this by our own power. And then things happen. We go up, out, we are off on our own, as he does. He goes up there to live with Laban up there in Syria. And for the first time in his life, he's got somebody who can scheme better than he can. And it just comes right back. And isn't that so typical of what the angels do? When we have a weakness and we've got a problem that they have to sort of fine-tune about our character, there's nothing better than bringing a new brother or sister into the ecclesia that can just, handle that problem that we have and let us see it, and we see it in them, and all of a sudden we realize, wow, is that really what I'm doing? And what a great way of showing us that this is an area that we need to work on, or showing us that, we can't keep operating like this because look at the destructiveness of that type of character. And we see it in somebody else. And then all of a sudden one day somebody says, well, you're sort of like that brother or sister. And we realize that, wow, that, we get a little chance to self-reflect. And that's what they did with Jacob. It's such a pure case of angels working in his life. And as he leaves the land, if you go back to where he first left, a little bit earlier, and you come back to, it's in Genesis 8. Genesis 28 is really where he's leaving, so let's start off there. When he's leaving the land, and he's on his way up, he's going to leave all his family behind, and he's leaving Israel, he's going to go up to the north, go on up to Syria, up into Paddan Aram, and he's going to go find out, because Rebekah has to send him away because they're afraid Esau is going to kill him. So, for those of you young people that are here and you think you've got it bad in your little family life with your brothers and sisters, here's a brother who literally wanted to kill his brother, and he needed to get out of there. And all of his scheming now was going to cost him ever seeing his mom again. And there are always consequences to this, but it certainly doesn't write him off. He's not a brother that you write off. He's just somebody who needed some fine-tuning. So he goes up in Genesis 28, and he's going to leave the land. And for the first time, really, he's sort of on his own. He's leaving his family behind. There's no longer Abraham. There's no longer Isaac. There's no longer mom, Rebekah. He's going off on his own to a whole new land. So he makes, when he sets out in verse 10, he leaves Beersheba, he goes up towards Haran, he stops at a certain place, which is probably Bethel, and he stays there all night, and he takes the stones and sets it down, and there's the dream, the dream that we cover this dream in Sunday school. But there are in the dream, when he sets up this stone and he dreams that there's this ladder, Jacob, and the angels of God, and you got an underline, highlight or something, they are definitely said to be ascending and descending. And many brethren have pointed out, when you listen to talks and tapes and so on, that there must be a reason that it's said that way. It's not that the angels were descending down to Jacob and then going back up, but it's that the angels were already here. He just hadn't caught on to that. He's a man who was a bit so busy in his life, caught up in his career or caught up in all the things that he was hoping to do. He hadn't taken the time yet to realize that all these things that he was busily scurrying around about, making plans about, and scheming about, that there were angels there with him all the time. He didn't need to be doing all those schemes, that he could have just been a little more aware of God's presence. And it was going to take this event in his life in order for that to happen with him. going up there and spending some time with good old Uncle Laban. So in verse 15, the angel tells him and says, look, I'm with you wherever you go, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done what I've spoken to you. And, you know, that's the nice thing about the angels. And that promise, brothers and sisters, and to the children that are here as well, or the teenagers, this promise is there for all of us that have been brought to the family of God. This is part of the privilege that we have. Out of all the millions and billions of people on this earth, God is only selecting a few. And it's not because we're better than everybody else out there. It might be because you've got an aunt, an uncle, you've got a grandpa, a grandma, a mom and dad who's prayed that the angels will work in your life, that God will call you out of all the people of this world. And he has. And here you are this weekend. And what a thing to be thankful for, that in the same way as Jacob setting out on his own right there, and the angels promise to be with him in this case, and they will not leave him and forsake him. It's the same promise that we have. It's the one that Paul echoes in Romans 8, that, you know, that God will never, or that Joshua echoed rather later on, that God, he'll never leave you or forsake you. That Paul picks up in Hebrews 13. That's a promise that God makes, that he'll stay with us wherever we go. Some of you may notice back in verse 13 that when he saw the Lord in verse 13, and the Lord stood, my version says above it, as though God was up above the ladder. But you look at the word that's used in the Hebrew, it says he was standing beside the ladder. And it's possible that that angel of the Lord was the one that was actually working with Jacob, and that angel was standing there right next to the ladder on earth. Now, Brother John Martin made quite a point about that, that the angel is not, he doesn't see the Lord way up there. He sees the Lord in the vision. He sees him right here next to him by the ladder, standing right there. And other angels are going up and down and up and down. And that's the vision that Jacob probably saw, because that angel that talked with him promised and said, I'm with you, Jacob. I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to stay with you up in Paddan Aram, and I'm going to bring you back. And he made that promise to stick with him all the way through the time. If you follow through Jacob's life then, and you know, you look at all those things, actually there's another case in Genesis 31 if you're just looking through it at some of the stories about the angels with Jacob, but there's another angel that shows up in chapter 31 if we go ahead. He spends all that time up there with Laban. And you know all the story, what goes on, and Laban changes his wages, and you know, here he thinks he's going to marry Rachel, and he ends up getting Leah. All those scheming things that had happened, the angels just kept throwing things back at him. And, you know, brothers and sisters, you could spend forever on Jacob's life, but I'll tell you another thing we can all leave here from this weekend about, is that when we start to realize how much the angels are involved in our life, we quit fighting it. It brings peace to your life. You don't have to fight the things that happen. Jacob fought the fact that he was given the wrong wife. He fought the fact the way they changed his wages. He was always scheming with things earlier in his life. And it wasn't until he finally reached the point that he realized that God really was in control that finally he was at peace. And that's a tough lesson to learn. It takes a lot of us a lifetime to learn it. It just takes forever. But there's things that happen where all of a sudden angels throw something at us. They throw an illness into our life that nobody has an answer to. They give us a child that just is different. They bring situations that we're struggling with a mom and a dad. And we realize this is out of our control. And when finally enough of those things happen, then we finally start to realize that, wow, this is God in control here. And all I'm doing is a piece of the action. And we start grabbing for angels. You know, help me, as you see with Jacob's struggle. But in Genesis 31, he's on his way back. He's on his way back. And look at how God had to intervene in this case on the way back. When he first leaves, now he's spent all his time with Laban, and he's coming back down. He's got this whole family of people, all these children he's got, four different wives in a sense, this big old family coming down. And we might look at that and say, well, look at all the things that Jacob got up there in Syria. And Jacob looks at all those things and he says, what a mess. What a mess. You know, you get into his shoes for a moment, he was in trouble. He was in big trouble. None of his wives got along. His kids hated each other. Nothing. He's big family. And it may have looked to us like, oh my, I wish I had all Jacob's stuff. But boy, we wouldn't have wanted to walk 2 minutes in his shoes. And that's another lesson of ecclesial life, because sometimes we do look at other brethren and sisters and we think, look at all the stuff they have. Look at the great life they have. Look at the big family they have. Look at all the children they have. Look at all the things that they have. I wish I had all that stuff. You wouldn't have wanted to walk 1 minute in Jacob's shoes. He had all the stuff. But boy, did he have the troubles with it. And that's the part of other people's lives we don't know. Be glad we don't know it in a sense, because if we knew all those things, we'd probably cry our eyeballs out for our brothers and sisters every night in prayer, realizing that they've got it a lot rougher than we ever thought. But we just don't know each other that well, and we hide a lot of those things from each other. But you find that out. You talk to people in ecclesial life about the struggles they're going through. Most of the people in our community are going through tough family struggles. Husbands, wives, children, everybody. Because the angels are challenging us to our limit so that we'll learn to rely on God and not rely on ourselves. They have to. They don't have a choice on that. They have to do that. But we might think about our own life that, you know, we've got some of the worst circumstances and we wish we had the life of brother or sister so-and-so. But everybody is being challenged to their limit in order for us to come through this thing, relying on God and not relying on ourselves. You can see that in Jacob's life, when he talks to Laban, one of the things that he points out, he said, look, in verse 42, when Laban finally meets up with them, he said, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction, the labor of my hands, and rebuked you last night. Now, he says God had done that, but really it was an angel that had done all that. But Jacob realized, and this is a perspective that we get out of this study, that God gets all the credit. It's all of God. But what he's doing is he's doing it on a daily basis through these angels that actually get involved. When Jacob finally does get down there, and he's ready to meet up with Esau, I just want to skip ahead and look at that one for a minute. He's getting ready to meet up with Esau, and you go through the story where he's wrestling. And we'll maybe look at that and leave it at that for this morning, because this is one of those key stories about angels in our lives. Here, you know the story. Jacob, he gets away from Laban, and you think, made it away from Laban. Now we got to look at the next part of this mission, because, you know, it's one thing to have somebody chasing you down. It's a whole other thing to be able to at least get away from him and be safe where you're going. These angels, as put into Jacob's life, this man was so boxed in that they were going to make him trust in God. It was like, that's what it took to break this scheming in his character. Here he is leaving Syria up there in the north. The man's chasing him on the way down. And what's he supposed to meet up with when he gets down into the land? He's meeting up with his brother who wants to kill him. And that's Jacob's life at this point. And he's getting boxed in and hemmed in on all the sides. And it's like there's no way. The only way out is to let go. As Bob Lloyd would say, let go and let God. That's really where Jacob was at this point. So he sends all the family across the river. And he gets left alone in Genesis 32. And the man wrestles him with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he did not prevail against him, this is the angel saw that he did not prevail against him, he touches the socket of his hip, and his hip's now out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he says, let me go, for the day breaks. And this is the angel saying that. But Jacob says to him, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Now, can you imagine being in that circumstance? You know, he just got away from Laban. He's going to meet up with his brother now. He sends all his family across the river. It looks like he goes back, and he probably went back to pray. He knew that there was no way out of this. He's going to meet up with Esau, and Esau could just take his family and just hack him to pieces if he wanted to. And that would be the end of the family line. And he's going to tell that, look, you promised me you would be with me. You promised me you'd bring me back to this land, and you would save me. But Jacob's not just interested in them living. He realizes we've got a bigger problem involved now. My family's growing up. My children are getting older. My wives still haven't reconciled with each other. This whole family is falling apart. This is like an ecclesia, a little small ecclesia where brethren are bickering and sisters are bickering and nobody's getting along and the whole thing's falling apart. He's not just asking for life. He's asking for spiritual direction. And he grabs a hold and he wrestles with this angel and he's holding on to him and he's holding on to him all through the night. This angel could have easily overcome Jacob. There would have been no problem. This angel could have, you know, and sometimes we do this with each other. We just do it the easy way and we just say a word where we put the person off and they walk away. This angel could have easily just done something to Jacob and just walked away. But this angel is allowing Jacob to wrestle out in his life the struggles that he's going through, the wrestling with God, where he's finally leaving the scheming aspect of his life. And he's ready to grab a hold of God and hold on to him and beg him and plead with God that you've got to do something with my children. You've got to help me with my wives. This whole family is falling apart. How are we ever going to develop the promised line when it looks like the truth is dying out in this family? And he doesn't want to let him go. And if you think that's the wrong perspective, the commentary that we get out of Hosea 12 is really what backs this up. If you look in Hosea 12, when Hosea is taking the life of Jacob, and he's saying, look, brethren and sisters, this life of Jacob wasn't just written down for Jacob. It was written down for all of us, because we all go through this same pattern of life. We all start out as children, and we struggle with God. We scheme. We make these kind of things. We don't have any idea that angels are out there working with us. We're not even aware of their presence. We all start out with that. And we all leave at some point. We go off into Syria. We go off into Paddan Aram. And all of a sudden, the struggles of life come in. We get to a point where we realize that everything's falling apart with all our scheming. We cannot do it. We cannot save ourselves. We cannot save our family. And at some point, we let go of that, and we turn on to God. And we start to realize that there's angels there. There's people there to help. We don't have to do it all. And he said, look, this was so typical of you, Hosea says. This is what the community, what Israel has gone through for hundreds of years. That this man took his brother by the heel in the womb. And in his strength, he struggled with God. In his strength, he's struggling away. And yes, when he struggled with the angel, because that's how we find out it wasn't just a man back there. It really was an angel. And he prevailed. The angel let him prevail at this point. But you find out that this isn't Jacob. He's not one of these wrestler fellows who's, yeah, he would have probably been a pretty strong man as a farmer back then, as raising the sheep. He probably, you know, we know that he was able to move the stone. There were things that Jacob was a strong man. But when he wrestled with God, he wasn't wrestling from the perspective of strength. He was wrestling with tears. He's crying. He's pleading with that angel. You can imagine this man just crying out his soul. Don't leave me. Don't let this family fall apart. You've got to do something to bring this ecclesia back together. And if we could only do that, brethren and sisters, if everybody would go home and do that in their families, in their ecclesias, look at what a difference our community would be. If we were praying for each other like that, asking for God's favor, struggling with the angels that are there, realizing that, I don't want to say something about Brother Ron that would offend Brother Ron, because Brother Ron's angel's here, and he's working with him. And I have to be aware that every one of us have angels that are trying to work with us. They're trying to develop our character, and they're doing the best that we can. We don't want to work against another brother or sister's angel. We don't want to make their job more difficult. We want to make it so that the angels are finding it easier to work in ecclesial life, and we want to join them in their work. And this is the struggle that Jacob's going through, and he's pleading with this angel, and there he found him. That's when Jacob finally found God in his life in Bethel, and there he spoke to us. And see, that's Hosea's commentary on that. It wasn't that he was just speaking to Jacob at that point. He was speaking to all of us, that this is the struggle of life that we go through. And he tells him at that point that your name will no longer be Jacob, because you've struggled with God and with men, and you prevailed. And Jacob asked him, and he wants to know his name. And it wasn't important that he know the individual name of that angel. This is part of it's the wonderful name. It's the same problem that Manoah and his wife had. This is part of the Yahweh name that this angel was revealing. And he was part of the work of God. And it didn't really matter which angel it actually was. But you can see in verse 30 that he calls the name of the place Peniel, because he had seen God face to face and his life was preserved. Now, that's as far as we'll get this morning on that story, and we'll pick up a little more in the exhortation, but I hope you can see that in the life of this man, God has left on record for us the struggles that go on, the involvement of the angels, and when we're ready to let go, the angels will be there, and they're ready to pick up the pieces.